You're listening to 88.3
Southern FM.
Coming up right now is the Space Show. Welcome to the Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie. Richard's not here this evening, other family business, but we do have a special guest coming up on the show. It's Angelo De Grazia. So, we are going to go off to the moon. Well, we're going to try and get to the moon, but I don't know if we're going to make it tonight. We'll try. So let's see what happens now.
Let's take a trip to the moon. Come on, let's go for the moon. I want to go to the moon. Let's take a trip to the moon.
Our special guest this evening is Angelo De Grazia from the Space Association of Australia. Welcome to the Space Show, Angelo.
Hi, thank you, Andrew. Glad to be here.
We had some rather disappointing news today. I should play the news theme now. We got a little theme music for the theme, but I haven't queued it up. What's the bad news?
Well, the bad news is that the Artemis II launch to the moon has been postponed for another month.
Tell us about Artemis II. What is it?
Artemis II is the first trip for humans back to the vicinity of the moon since 1972, which was the Apollo 17 mission. And the idea really is to launch from Earth, some testing around Earth orbit, get into a high Earth orbit, and then shoot out to a free return trajectory is the word that I'm looking for. And that means that if something goes wrong on the way to the moon will just deflect it back to the Earth. And that was going to happen this weekend.
Oh. So how come I didn't notice?
Well, because they cancelled it. What they do before a launch is they have what's called a wet dress rehearsal, which is you put the stack on the pad, you fill it up with hydrogen and liquid oxygen. Liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. And then you bring the count to maybe within 30 seconds of firing the engines, and then you stop. So you check all the systems all the way down to that point. And unfortunately, when they had it the other day, they had hydrogen leaks. And as a consequence, they had to scrub the launch.
I'm getting deja vu because I remember you being on air about 3 years ago.
Correct.
Talking about hydrogen leaks.
Well, funny that. In Artemis 1, which occurred a few years back, I was there at the Cape. And in fact, two flight attempts were actually cancelled because of hydrogen leaks. And it wasn't till a few months later that they actually launched Artemis 1. So this hydrogen leak problem seems to have gone all the way through for another 2.5 years, and here we are again, exactly the same problem. Now, in fairness to NASA, hydrogen is, you know, the smallest molecule in the universe and really hard to seal. However, my take on this is that NASA have been using hydrogen since the Apollo days and went on to 100-plus space shuttle missions using hydrogen. They had some problems in those days too, but to have two significant missions virtually grounded by hydrogen leaks is really a worry.
So my understanding is that Artemis II the launch dates are limited. They can't just say, oh, well, today we'll go If can't go today, well, maybe tomorrow.
There's
set dates, aren't there?
Correct. In March, I think there's about six dates that are starting, I think, on the 6th of March or thereabouts. And if they miss any of those six dates, they've got to go into April. And that's the problem. The problem is that in February, we had 6 days or so very close to each other. And
5 days, yeah.
It was five, was it? Okay. And so they've missed that opportunity, and now they're into March. And if they miss that next opportunity, they'll be into April.
Yeah. So if they'd gone this month, it could have been February 6, 7, 8, 10 or 11. For some reason, they missed 9. What determines the dates they can launch? Is it the phase of the moon? Because if you look at the moon right now, it's pretty full. And if you look at these dates coming up, it would be more... See, when it's full, the dark, the far side of the moon used to be called
the dark side of the moon.
Good album. It's dark. It's dark. Whereas in a few weeks, you know, a few days' time, there'll be sunlight on that far side of the moon.
I think that has a bearing on it, but I'm not quite sure that's the whole story. There's a celestial dance that occurs and positioning, and it's to do where Florida is at a particular time, and there's also a number of issues, I believe. It's not just the lighting. The lighting will become really important in Artemis 3 when they supposedly will land on the moon, and they're landing at the South Pole with nice long shadows. So that's going to have to be a real coordination effort. But Artemis 2, I'm not sure just how much the light influences that mission.
People will have forgotten that Apollo also had limited launch dates. And fortunately, every time they met those dates. But if they'd missed them, they would have to skip a month until the next available date. But that was determined, from my memory, by the lighting conditions at the landing site.
Correct.
They wanted to land in the early morning, so they had shadows. Because if you wait until the sun's overhead, there's no shadows from the rocks and things, and it's hard to judge your height and, you know, where you're landing.
Correct. That was definitely a prime consideration in Apollo. Mm. Artemis 2, not sure how big an issue it is, because I know that they do intend to be looking at things that no human eyes have seen before, because the Apollos just didn't pass through those areas, whilst Artemis 2 will. But Artemis 2 will also be very high. It's not, you know, your 100-kilometre orbits that Apollo were in. These guys are, you know, 10,000 kilometre away, orbit as they slingshot. So they slingshot their way around the moon.
So if February's obviously off the cards now.
Yep.
Totally. Not even February 11.
Nope. It's not. It's totally off the cards. We don't even know if they're rolling back the Artemis back to the vertical assembly building. They may have to do that. I remember when I was there a few years back, they actually fixed the leak, or they tried to fix it, with on-site. Right on the launch pad, and they had to build scaffolds and protection around it, and it was really complicated. They still failed to launch while I was there, NASA will pull out all stops to try to fix it, but it's just disheartening that 2.5 years later, here we are again, same problem.
Okay. So the possible launch dates in March, I've got written here, March the 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, and 11th. No 10th.
No 10th.
And do you reckon they'll make March?
I don't know. I'm not high. I'm confident, but not fully confident. I'd like to know what the impact of the new NASA administrator will be in all this, Jared Isaacman. Mm-hmm. You know, if one was a cynic, one would say, holy cow, you know, SLS, that's not a cost-plus contract, is it? And I think that Isaacman will really put the foot down and say what the hell is going on and try to fix it. I really believe he's in it for that purpose. no mucking around. But it could be a difficult problem to fix. It could be inherent in the design that's causing this issue.
All right. And if they do go to April, the launch dates I've got written here are the 1st, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, and 20th. I think, no, oh, 30th, sorry. 30th. So, you know, 30th is like the beginning of the May launch periods.
What you'll find is that there's a certain level of acceptance of leak, and they may, to get this thing off the ground, relax it. They say that, no, safety is paramount, but when push comes to shove and they get desperate, they might just relax how much of a leak is a leak, because they do have tolerances into how much can actually leak, and it does, but what you find is that they will scrub a launch if it exceeds a certain percentage.
On the shuttle, they used to have igniters that go and was igniting any leaking hydrogen before they actually started the main shuttle engines.
I believe they still have them on the SLS, because SLS is a shuttle-derived vehicle, a 40-year-old technology, not to put too fine a point to it.
Yes. All right. Now, I've heard that people saying that Artemis 2 is like Apollo 8 and others saying it's like Apollo 13. But I don't think it's like either of those missions. What's the difference?
Okay. Let's go Apollo 8. It actually was launched on what's called the free return trajectory. And the idea there was that if the service module failed to ignite or caused a problem, they would swing around a moon and come back Apollo 13 style. Okay. Go back to Apollo 8. However, their service module worked, and Apollo 8 was able to get into lunar orbit at the 100-kilometre mark or whatever the number is, and they were able to orbit the moon for, I think it was 10 orbits?
10 orbits, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
And then they fired their engine again and came back to Earth. Apollo 13, they had their explosion sort of three-quarters away or halfway, I forget where, and thankfully they were on a free return trajectory, which meant...
No, they weren't.
They were. I think they were.
No, they were not, and they had to do that engine burn to get onto the free return.
Really?
Really?
I always thought that they were a free return trajectory. Okay. No, Andrew,
we'll fact check that sometime. Well,
yeah, that's an interesting point. But you're right, because they had to do two burns, in fact. They had to do the burn on the way to the moon and one coming back. But I thought they were just adjustments rather than, you know, getting them into a free return trajectory. Yeah. But we'll fact check that. Yeah. That's a good point.
Just after they'd gone round the moon, was to speed them up to get them back a day earlier.
Correct.
Right. Whereas I thought the first one was to get them onto the free return path. But back check me.
No. I'm with you. Now you've got me wondering my facts. But I'd like to know the facts. But you're right that they did one burn to speed up, which you wouldn't have done on a free return. You would just go around the moon. But it's a good point. We will do a fact check.
All right. Now, we will have a little song which looks back to the days when they were doing moon flights. And he says, just trying to find the piece of paper that's got it written on. And it's a group called Drive By Truckers. And it's called Putting People on the Moon. And it's about the closure of the Ford factory at a town downriver from Huntsville, Alabama. Now, Alabama is the home of the NASA Marshall Space Flight Center, which tested the engines of the Saturn V rockets that put man on the moon. But layoffs are even occurring at NASA. So this is sort of bemoaning the end of the Apollo program. So let's have a listen.
Like I did, we got married on a Monday. I've been working ever since.
You know, I was
every week down at the Ford plant, but now they're shutting down. Goddamn Reagan's in the White House and nobody gives a damn. Yeah. Double digit unemployment, DEA is shutting soon. No Larry Huntsville putting people on the moon. Really tough to make a living, but a man still gotta try. And if I died in Colbert County, would it make the evening news? We're too busy blowing rockets, putting people on the moon. Quit asking, why I do the things I do. I ain't saying that she likes it, but what else we gonna do? If I could solve the world's problems, probably start with hers and mine. We can put a man on the moon, but I'm stuck down here just scraping by. Here. It seems everyone I know is getting cancer every year. We can't afford no insurance. I've been 10 years unemployed. So she didn't get no chemo and our lives was destroyed. And nothing really changes. The cemeteries get more full. Every couple of years in Huntsville, they keep saying that NASA's gonna shut down too.
That was the Drive-By Truckers with Putting People on the Moon. And I think they could take some singing lessons. But anyway. Now, Angelo, we've just done a fact check. What was the result?
Well, I'm going to have to defer to the older statesmen here. And Andrew was right. The Apollo 13 was actually not on a free return trajectory. Andrew and I thought that that was probably the first mission where they didn't have a free return trajectory, and they were basically utilizing what was called a hybrid trajectory, which was designed to miss the Earth by, I'll quote the miles here, 40,000 miles, which required two burns to get them back onto free return.
Thank you, Angelo. And we'll be back with you, Angelo, in a few moments, and we're going to talk about America's new space policy. But first, we have these messages.
88.3 Southern FM.
We have our guest on the space show this evening is Angelo De Grazia from the Space Association of Australia. He gives a lot of talks at the Space Association meetings and is quite an expert on the American space events. In December, President Trump signed one of his executive orders. He's done hundreds of them. But this one is about space, and it's called Ensuring American Space Superiority. What on earth is this all about, Angelo?
Okay. As you rightly said, on December the 18th, an executive order was signed. It's really a small document, it's only about 3 pages, but it actually replaces what normally would be a thick document talking about what America's space policy is all about. But he basically put forward a new space policy for the United States. And it was just basically on the same day that Jared Isaacman, billionaire astronaut, on-again, off-again administrator, was actually sworn in as the administrator of NASA. So what is this policy? What it is, it's an executive order that functions as a de facto U.S. national space policy for the current administration. Okay, so like I said, rather than a formal document, we have this three-page document that covers all the issues. It covers civil, commercial, and national security space activities through the late 20s and beyond. This will probably impact American space probably for the next decade. It signals a real shift towards an assertive leadership, competition, and hard timelines. And I guess I want to stress the assertive leadership. It really comes through in the document. Jared said, and he would say this, that it was the most significant space policy since Kennedy. And if you remember the your history, Kennedy was the guy that said that they would land a man on the moon by the end of the decade, which they did. He also stated that he would intensively focus the agency to achieve the near impossible. And when you look at some of the dates, you can understand why he said that. Okay, go on, Andrew.
Okay, so they want to be the leaders in space.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's nice to be the leader, but why do they want to be the leader in space?
Well, that's a good question, but I think if you look at the way Trump is running America at the moment, he wants to be preeminent in everything, and it's a go-alone preeminent to basically exert authority over his domain, whatever that might be. So space is just the next frontier. And when you read the policy, you can actually see it in the policy, and it focuses quite significantly on defense.
So he wants to have Americans on the moon by 2028.
He does. Do you want me to go through some of these?
Yes.
All right. Let's start off with the first header was core policy priorities. So the first one was leadership in space exploration. He commits to return Americans to the moon by 2028. That's only 2 years away, 2.5 years away. It's a tall order, but, you know, as we would all know, these human landing systems are currently being developed. And the question is, are they going to be ready? So that is as Jared would say, achieve the impossible. So 2028.
Now, Kennedy in 1961 said, yep, go for the moon by the end of the decade, which most people interpreted as end of 69 rather than 70.
Correct.
And there they were, 8 years later, on the moon. When did Trump say we're going to go to the moon?
Look, in fairness, Trump was the one who actually initiated this current moon initiative.
Yes.
In his first term, he was the one that pushed it along, and he wanted, if you recall, landing at 2024 because that was the end of his second term. And on this occasion, in his second round, he's now dictated that they would land on the moon by the end of his second term, which is 2028. But we're further advanced than we were in the days of Apollo when Kennedy said, you know, I mean, they had just launched Alan Shepard at the time, and that's all the runs they had on the board. So they have got a fair bit of technology in advance, but 2028 is a tall order. They're going to have to really push it. And Isaacman, the NASA administrator, has committed himself to finding other solutions if he can. So that was the first item. The next one was to establish initial elements of a permanent lunar outpost by 2030. And then the third goal was to sustained lunar presence as a stepping stone to Mars. Now, why those dates? Those dates reflect what's happening with the Chinese space program, because they've also said we're landing it in 2030. So what this is about is direct challenge to China's ambitions as well. So we're in a space race. That's the bottom line to this.
I'm reminded of the 1960s when the rhetoric was beat Russia, beat Russia. Now you just cross out Russia and put in C-I-C-H-I-N-A, and you've got the same sort of thing.
Absolutely. And Jared at the moment, Jared Isaacman, is actually looking at alternatives to the current landers. You might find that there might be a sort of an interim lander that just gets boots on the ground, puts a flag in and comes home. Because the current HLS plans that has been on the planning books for a while was to actually have a sustainable lunar presence, right? With, you know, big technology, get on the moon, stay. I think they're going to just bypass that just for the first couple of flights.
Okay. So these pictures we see of them unloading 100 tons of cargo from the HLS.
SpaceX one.
Is fantasy at the moment.
At the moment, yes. Mm-hmm. At the moment. But we'll see what happens. You know, SpaceX might surprise everybody. And, you know, they are a class organisation. So, you know, could they pull the rabbit out of the hat? The next header was national and economic security. Okay. This is the military component. Treats space explicitly as a contested operational domain, which means anywhere between low Earth orbit, cislunar space, the moon is now contested space. And it's written in those words, essentially.
It sounds like the Monroe Doctrine.
Yep, but out into space.
Yep.
Absolutely. The manifest destiny, as they call it. Strengthens US ability to detect, characterize, and counter space threats across all orbits. Now, the detect and the characterize is the benign component. The more sinister component is counter space threats. That could mean anything to missiles in space, which is under treaty was basically banned, but treaties have been basically put to one side. He calls for the next generation missile defense technologies by 2028. I haven't investigated that to great depth, but that could be part of that golden dome that you hear talked about protecting the United States by a missile defense system. In the old days, back in the 90s, we used to call it Star Wars, a Ronald Reagan initiative.
Officially the Strategic Defense Initiative.
Correct. Correct, which everyone calls Star Wars. It emphasizes resilience and protection of space infrastructure. And it means anything, as I say, all the way to the moon. The worry I've got is that I don't know how much research they've done, but if they really did get into a fight in space, there's a thing called the Kessler syndrome, which says that at some point the density of space objects are going to be so numerous that one collision will result in a chain reaction that could make some orbital, planes impenetrable.
That would be very familiar to those who saw the movie Gravity.
Correct. All right. The next header was commercial space economy. It aims to attract up to $50 billion in the new private investment by 2028. $50 billion, huge amount of money, and it's basically from the commercial space end. The Americans will put in that money as well through NASA, but that's a lot of money. It pushes regulatory streamlining for launches and re-entries. So They want to streamline. Remember Elon Musk kept complaining about the FAA's slow pace and bureaucratic pace of certifying their rocket launches? Well, truth be known, they have been working on it now for the year and even before that to streamline that process.
I can see here on the screen, I can see Elon's fingerprints on that on that phrase, because that was a very sore point with him.
Yes, it was. And there's a couple of places where I can see fingerprints from Elon in this. So that's an interesting point you make. Direct's development of a pathway to a commercial successor to the ISS in low Earth orbit by 2030. In other words, we know that the ISS will be deorbited.
ISS being the International Space Station.
Sorry, yep. Will be deorbited by 2030, and it will be deorbited by SpaceX, none other. And after that, this directive says that we are going to go commercial space stations. And in fact, we've got a couple of, we've probably got four or five players in the game. The first one will be from VAST that will be launched on a SpaceX rocket early next year, and that'll be the first of the commercial space stations. So that'll be an interesting, but now we get it in the policy itself. It deepens reliance on commercial launch and space services. So what it's really directing NASA to do, and this is Elon all over again, is to use commercial space more often in all the space activities that America embarks on. So that'll be good for Bezos, Blue Origin, and it will be good for SpaceX, but will also be good for a couple of other players that are coming up the ranks. Rocket Lab, who's the other guy? Stoke Space, and a few others. So Relativity Space, right? So there's a whole bunch of people that might benefit out of this. The next header was technology and capability development, explicit support for space nuclear power. So this is the first time they've really said, yep, we're going lunar, we're going nuclear. And it'll be nuclear power on the lunar surface through reactors and also orbital nuclear systems, probably more like the thermal nuclear reactors that they use, like Perseverance, Curiosity.
Yeah, they're not reactors as such. They are...
generators, yep.
Radioisotope thermoelectric generators.
Correct.
Which are not reactors. They're talking here about reactors, actual...
They're talking reactors.
Fission reactors.
Fission reactors on the moon. And they've set the date of 2030 of getting some of these things there. So we're
That's
not
only far. 4 years away.
I know. Now, in fairness, the Americans have been working on these for a little while, but it went into a bit of a hiatus, but it's now restarted.
Yeah.
So it'll be an interesting development. And
there's a good reason for having nuclear reactors on the moon, and that is the day-night cycle. Wherever you are, except a few little hilltops on the at the polar regions, you've got 14 days, Earth days, of daylight when you can use solar, and then 14 days of night where you can't use solar, and even with batteries. It's not good. So nuclear makes sense.
It's the perfect solution, actually. But it has to be developed and it has to be safe. So, again, the timelines are short. Jared Isaacman was a real supporter of space nuclear power, so he'll push this along quite vigorously. The other item is focus on cost-effective, sustainable architectures for exploration and defence. Also, accelerated development of security-relevant technology prototypes. The last header was whole-of-government coordination. Here's an interesting one. The National Space Council is basically revoked. The policy coordination shifts to, and the management of space policy is now within the White House, really close to the White House, through the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, OSTP is the acronym, and the Assistant to the President for Science and Technology, the APST. So that's an interesting thing. So Trump wants to take control of the Space Council. The Space Council, if you recall, brought together all the agencies in America into one room so that all the agencies could actually coordinate, communicate, and, you know, I guess optimize the way they deliver space in the United States. So I'm not sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but we've got to also remember that for many years we didn't have a Space Council.
Yeah. And the council was chaired by the vice president.
Correct. The last component was agencies are instructed to streamline procurement and execution. So that's a good thing to optimize the way they deliver. So they were the five key hitters that were in the space policy. So it leads us to what was really strongly emphasized, right? And what really was emphasized, which is new, was hard deadlines. The moon by 28, outpost on the moon by 2030. Rare in past policies. You won't see those specific dates mentioned on many other policies on space before. First clear policy endorsement of nuclear reactors in space and a strong push for commercial low Earth orbit infrastructure post the ISS. So that's good because we weren't certain what would happen after the ISS came down. But now it's written that the Americans intend to stay in orbit, but it will be commercialized. It won't be NASA necessarily. They'll probably buy services, but that's their intention. National security. There's a clear framing of space as strategically contested. That's now pretty clear. Explicit focus on counter space capabilities and missile defense. As we said, this is about now potentially militarizing space. Greater use of commercial tech in defense systems. So, in other words, try to streamline the costs of the defense budget, even though this year they had a defense budget, I think, of $1 trillion. And for what it's worth, NASA got $24.4 billion for this financial year or the next financial year to October 26. Space Force got 26. So they're putting a lot of money into defense and defense space. The last header here, the second last, is economy and industry sets measurable private investment targets. The $50 billion we spoke about, accelerates deregulation to increase launch cadence and competition. And in terms of organisation, we spoke about it, the management of space policy is now closer to the White House than it was before.
Well, thank you, Angelo. That's quite good. On balance, your personal opinion, not the Space Association's opinion, but your personal opinion, is it a good policy or not?
It's a mixed sword here. First off, you know, I applaud the dates for getting to the moon and doing various other things and sustainability, getting the space stations going. But unfortunately, I think a lot of it leans to defense. America, you know, when they talk about leadership in space, they really mean it. It emphasizes on defending the United States' interest from Earth orbit through to cislunar space and all that stuff, but it also pushes it from an American point of view, right? What's good for America? They want to take the high ground to be able to achieve its outcomes, and space will now become part of what you see in the global machinations of the Trump administration. Now it's going out to space as well. You said it before, the Monroe Doctrine, there's an element of that. Beat China to the moon and basically plant the flag and say, this is ours. I hope I'm wrong, but it's the two-edged sword.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll be back shortly here on The Space Show.
Thank you for 35 wonderful years. 88.3 Southern FM.
And on The Space Show, we are trying to do what Neil Diamond said. Let's take a trip.
trip to the moon. Come on, let's go for the moon. I wanna go to the moon. Let's take a trip to the moon.
We talked about the Apollo program earlier with Angelo, and I've got a song here which is about this. It's by Billy Bragg, and it's called Waiting for the Great Leap Forwards. The background is that a person with a mundane job stacking chairs at an exhibition reflects on dreams of what might have been in the 1960s. This is Billy Bragg.
Tonight's musical guest is Billy Bragg. The first time I saw Billy Bragg play was 23 years ago, and the quality of the man's work and his motivation for getting out there and doing it has never dipped or wavered. Whenever I see him play, it reminds me of what the music business is supposed to be all about. Here to play Waiting for the Great Leap Forward from his Workers Playtime album, recently re-released on his Volume 2 box set, here's Billy Bragg, live and uncut.
Some people sing about love, some people sing about war. Some people sing about a better world to come. Well, I sing about all three, and this is my theme song, Waiting for the Great Leap Forward.
It may have been Camelot for Jack and Jacqueline, but on the Hugo Chavez Highway, filling up with gasoline. Little Donald Rumsfeld spies a rich lady who's crying over luxury's disappointment, so he walks over and he's trying to sympathise with her, but he thinks that he should warn her to prepare to be bombed back into the Stone Age. Soviet Union, the citizens demand to know why they're still the target of strategic air command, and they shake their fists in anger and respectfully suggest we take the money from our missiles and spend on our hospitals instead. Over, but the stakes are getting higher. I'm frightened of collateral damage and a friendly fire, and I don't believe we can defeat no axis of evil by putting smart bombs in the hands of dumb people. And politics, they ask me what the use is. I offer them my acupuncturist, my masseuses, while looking down the corridor out to where my ego is waiting. I'm looking for the new world order. Sales are organised. All my mates got fat. Even after all this time, you can still send me a fax. You can be active with the act of this sort, sleeping with the media while you're waiting for the great leap forwards. Yeah. One leap forwards, two leaps back. Will YouTube give MTV the sack? Waiting for the great leap forwards. Well, here comes the future and you can't run from it. You've got a tattoo, Henry. I want to be on it, mate. Waiting for the great leap forwards. In a perfect world, we'd all sing in tune, but this is reality, not American Idol. Waiting for the great leap forwards. So join the struggle while you may. The revolution's just an ethical haircut away when you're waiting for the great leap forwards.
As the song said, waiting for a great leap forward, Billy Bragg. Now, we mentioned Jared Isaacman a little earlier. I've got a little piece here I recorded on December the 19th last year when a NASA administrator, the new sworn-in guy, was speaking to NASA employees on his second day in the job. Here is Jared Isaacman.
Good afternoon. I am really honored to be here today as NASA's 15th administrator, serving under President Trump's leadership and working alongside some of the greatest scientific and engineering minds this nation has to offer. I feel like I am living the dream right now. This is the agency that captivated me as a child, inspiring me to grow up reading every book on the subject I could on all of NASA's amazing accomplishments and all the pioneers and heroes that showed up to work here every day. This is the agency that has inspired the world again and again with images from our telescopes, our probes, and our rovers. This is the agency that sent astronauts to and from the moon at a time when we knew so little but believed we could do the impossible. So honestly, there's nowhere else I would rather be than right here, right now, alongside all of you at the most accomplished space agency in the world. I understand that with any leadership change comes some anxiety and uncertainty. But between two hearings, a few podcasts, a document that circulated a little wider than expected, there should really be no mysteries as to how I'm thinking about things. But more importantly, the president has released the National Space Policy, and in my view, it's one of the most significant commitments to America's space program by any administration since the Kennedy era. It lays out a very clear vision, provides unambiguous priorities, and sets timeframes for achievement. And as it's always been, the honor and exceptional responsibility rightfully falls on all of us here at NASA to deliver. So let me outline the direction that we're going to take together. America will lead in the peaceful exploration of space. We will bring extreme focus to the mission and realize our near-term objectives of returning American astronauts to the moon and establishing an enduring presence to unlock the scientific, economic, and national security potential on the lunar surface. We will look for every opportunity to pull forward the Artemis program to the limits that physics and safety afford, while increasing the flight cadence across the architecture authorized in the One Big Beautiful Bill. The next most significant milestone, of course, is Artemis II, launching on a historic mission early this coming year. At the same time, we will prepare for the inevitable return by working with our commercial and our international partners to ensure they are aligned with our programmatic objectives and acting with the urgency needed to deliver the launch services, the vehicles, the suits, the habitat, surface power, and rovers required for frequent, affordable missions to the lunar environment. And our journey does not end on the moon. As directed in the National Space Policy, we will accelerate investments in next-generation programs that only NASA is capable of leading, including nuclear surface power and propulsion, technologies that will usher in the next giant leap in space exploration and discovery. Now, we must ignite the orbital and eventual lunar economy. For more than a half century, the space economy has been terrestrially anchored in launch communication and observation, with world governments as the primary customer. That perpetual taxpayer-dependent model won't fund the future we've all imagined. Alongside industry and academia, we must uncover the long-awaited promise of pharmaceuticals, biotech, on-orbit computing, anything that can contribute to and perhaps someday entirely justify the cost of maintaining inhabited orbital outposts and generating value far in excess of what it costs to operate in space. Working with industry and academia, we will do all we can to maximize the remaining life of the International Space Station, prioritizing the highest potential science and research with the aim of determining this new orbital economy so that in the future we will transition from one station to many. NASA will become a force multiplier for science. With an immense hunger for the data and enthusiasm to deliver the world-changing headlines that only NASA is capable of achieving, we will endeavor to reduce the time to science and maximize the scientific value of every dollar that's available. Now, I do not believe this is a one-size-fits-all approach. We will embrace a full menu of possibilities. So that includes bespoke missions to extraordinary destinations, an expanded CLIPS-style missions that accept more risk for faster discovery, partnering with industry to gather Earth observation data more efficiently and affordably without sacrificing continuity, and lending NASA expertise and resources to enable academic institutions to take on bold scientific missions. Some approaches may be a flavor of the way it has always been done, and some will be a new way. But in all cases, we will challenge the process in every way with the goal of arriving at the desired results as expeditiously and affordably as possible, because if NASA doesn't do it, no one else will. Now, accomplishing our mission will not be easy, but at NASA, it never was, and it never should be. Engineering and program management challenges are just part of the story. We have a great competitor that is moving at absolutely impressive speeds, and it's unsettling to consider the implications if we fail to maintain our technological, scientific, or economic edge in space, and the clock is running. These are fiscally challenging times, and I do support the president and his goal to get spending under control and bring down the national debt. Now, this is hardly NASA-specific, but we as a nation can't spend our way out of every problem and believe it will lead to better outcomes. So I don't know where the budgets will land, but I will always advocate passionately for the agency, knowing we will make the most of every dollar entrusted to us. And I'm not arriving with all the answers. I do know this: we cannot achieve our objectives by doing things the way they've been done in recent years, and we know most of the NASA IG reports would echo this sentiment. So we must do all we can to minimize the bureaucratic drag that can slow us down and slow down the great engineers and scientists, and eliminate obstacles that impede progress, flatten the organizational structure to improve information flow and accelerate sound decision making, and push responsibility down to the talent that is more than capable of getting the job done. And when we do, we must rightfully recognize and reward the contributors that bring the near impossible to reality. NASA must be one of the hardest, most demanding places to work in this country, because lives depend on our work, and the world is counting on our breakthroughs and discoveries. It's why you see the NASA logo anywhere you travel. I mean, people the world over know that we are capable of accomplishing, and the expectations are rightfully very high. We are not alone in the need to evolve to meet the moment. Our international and commercial partners have made commitments as well, and we must place as much pressure on them to deliver as we do on ourselves. No changes happen in a vacuum. I plan to speak with many of you, the leadership teams, the engineers, scientists, astronauts, our program managers, and the people in the field doing the work. I will visit every center in the weeks ahead and engage with our international and commercial partners. I want to hear directly what is broken so we can work together to fix it, and where we are excelling so we can do a lot more of it. It's been a year, but we have real momentum now. NASA has the enthusiastic interest of President Trump, the Vice President, the Cabinet. We have bipartisan congressional support. We have a national space policy outlining the most righteous and inspiring objectives. We have the mandate. We have the talent, the partners, and the resources to get the job done and bring billions of people along with us on this journey. I don't think there are many NASA employees standing next to you who served during the Apollo era. They have retired. In many cases, they've passed on, leaving their extraordinary accomplishments behind for us to celebrate. But now, you will be the ones in the room when we return. You will be part of the next chapter of this history. And this time, when we make the grand return, we stay. Thank you.
That was Jared Isaacman, the new administrator of NASA, trying to gee up the forces. This has been The Space Show, which has a home on the internet as space.southernfm.com.au, space.southernfm.com.au. We've got no time left to talk with Angelo anymore, but he was smiling at some of the things that Jared was saying there. I'm Andrew Rennie. This has been The Space Show on Southern FM.